getting ready to hit the wet dirt. A small dark man checked his watch again. Ellie hid under the sheet.
Over 3 hours, the man said.
Ellie said nothing.
Can you tell the time?
Ellie straightened up in the bed and pulled the sheet down slowly, all the way past her mouth.
I'm 6 and a half,
she said. The man nodded.
Look, he said.
He held out his arm and twisted his wrist.
1 more hour, he said.
Then what?
The man looked away. Ellie watched him a long moment more. Then she pulled the sheet back over her head. The thunder boomed and the lightning flashed. The flash lit up the whole landscape for miles ahead. The crash of thunder crowded in on top of it. Reacher dropped to a crouch and stared.
She wasn't there.
She was nowhere in front of him. The lightning died and the thunder rolled on. For a second, he wondered whether he would hear her gun over it.
Would he?
Or would the first he knew be the sickening impact of the bullet? He dropped full length into the mud and lay still, felt the rain lashing his body like 1,000 tiny hammers.
Okay, rethink.
Had she outflanked him? She could have attempted an exact mirror image of his own move, in which case they had each sprinted a wide, fast circle in opposite directions and essentially exchanged positions. Or she could have found a sinkhole or a crevasse and gone to ground. She could have found the jeep. If she had glanced backward during a lightning strike, she would have seen it. It was an easy conclusion that he'd have to get back to it eventually. How else was he going to get out of the desert? So maybe she was waiting there. Maybe she was inside it, crouching low. Maybe she was under it, in which case he had just presented her with a Winchester rifle with 2 factory rounds still in the magazine. He stayed down in the mud, thinking hard. He ignored the next lightning flash altogether, just pressed himself into the landscape, calculating, deciding. He rejected the possibility of the flanking maneuver. That was military instinct. He was dealing with a street shooter, not an infantry soldier. No infantryman would aim for a guy's eye. Percentages were against it. So maybe she had gone for the jeep. He swam himself through a stationary, muddy circle and raised his head and waited. The next flash was a sheet, rippling madly and lighting the underside of the clouds like a battlefield flare. The jeep was a long way away. Too far, surely. And if she had gone for it, she was no immediate threat. Not all the way back there, not at that distance. So he swiveled back around and crawled down south. Check and clear, zone by zone. He moved slowly on his knees and elbows. 10 feet, 20, 25. It felt exactly like basic training. He crawled on and on, and then he smelled perfume. It was somehow intensified by the rain. He realized the whole desert smelled different. The rain had changed things entirely. He could smell plants and earth. They made a strong, pungent, natural odor, but mixed into it was a woman's perfume.
Was it perfume? Or was it something from nature, like a night flower suddenly blooming in the storm? No, it was perfume. A woman's perfume, no question about it. He stopped moving and lay completely still.
He could hear the mesquite moving, but it was only the wind. The rain was easing back toward torrential, and a strong, wet breeze was coming in from the south, teasing him with the smell of perfume. It was absolutely dark. He raised his gun and couldn't see it in his hand, like he was a blind man.
Which way is she facing? Not east. She had to be crouched low, so to the east there would be nothing to see except the blank
2-foot wall that was the edge of the mesa. If she was looking south or west, no problem. If she's looking north, she's looking straight at me. Except she can't see me. Too dark. She can't smell me either, because I'm upwind. He raised himself on his left forearm and pointed his gun straight from his right shoulder. If she was facing south or west, it would give him an easy shot into her back. But worst case, she's looking north, and we're exactly facing each other. We could be 5 feet apart, so it's a gamble now. When the lightning flashes, who reacts first? He held his breath, waited for the lightning. It was the longest wait of his life. The storm had changed. Thunder was rumbling long and loud, but it wasn't sharp anymore. The rain was still heavy. It kicked mud and grit up onto his face, thrashed against the brush. Brand new streams gurgled all around his prone body. He was half submerged in water. He was very cold. Then there was a split-second tearing sound in the sky, and a gigantic thunderclap crashed and a bolt of lightning fired absolutely simultaneously. It was impossibly white and harsh, and the desert lit up brighter than day. The woman was 3 feet in front of him. She was slumped face down on the ground, already battered by rain and silted with mud. She looked small and collapsed and empty. Her legs were bent at the knees and her arms were folded under her. Her gun had fallen next to her shoulder. A Browning high power. It was half submerged in the mud, and a small thicket of twigs had already dammed against one side of it. He used the last of the lightning flash to scrabble for it and hurl it far away. Then the light died, and he used the after image retained in his eyes to find her neck. There was no pulse. She was already very cold. Deflection shooting. His third bullet instinctively placed just ahead of her as she scrambled away from him. She had jumped straight into its path. He kept the fingers of his left hand on the still pulse in her neck, afraid to lose contact with her in the dark. He settled down to wait for the next lightning flash. His left arm started shaking. He told himself it was because he was holding it at an unnatural angle. Then he started laughing. It built quickly, like the rain. He had spent the last 20 minutes stalking a woman he had already shot dead. Accidentally. He laughed uncontrollably until the rain filled his mouth and set him coughing and spluttering wildly. The man stood up and walked over to the credenza, picked up his gun from where it was lying on the polished wood, ducked down to the black nylon valise, and took out a long black silencer, fitted it carefully to the muzzle of the gun, walked back to the chair and sat down again. "It's time," he said. He put his hand on her shoulder. She felt it through the sheet. She wriggled away from him, swam down in the bed and curled up. She needed to pee, very badly. "It's time," the man said again. He folded the sheet back. She scrabbled away, holding the opposite hem tight between her knees. Looked straight at him.
"You said 1 more hour," she said. "It hasn't been an hour yet. I'll tell that lady. She's your boss."
The man's eyes went blank. He turned and looked at the door just for a moment. Then he turned back.
"Okay," he said. "You tell me when you think it's been 1 more hour.
He let go of the sheet, and she wrapped herself up in it again, ducked her head under it, and put her hands over her ears to block the noise of the thunder. Then she closed her eyes, but she could still see the lightning flashes through the sheet and through her eyelids. They looked red. The next flash was sheet lightning again, vague and diffuse and flickering,
He rolled the body over just to be sure, tore open her jacket and shirt. He had hit her in the left armpit. It was through and through, exiting in the opposite wall of her chest. Probably got her heart, both lungs, and her spine. A .40 caliber bullet was not a subtle thing. It took a lot to stop one. The entry wound was small and neat. The exit wound wasn't. The rain flushed it clean. Diluted blood leaked all over the place and instantly disappeared. Her chest cavity was filling with water. It looked like a medical diagram. He could have sunk his whole hand in there. She was medium-sized, blonde hair, soaked and full of mud where it spilled out under the FBI cap. He pushed the bill of the cap upward so he could see her face. Her eyes were open and staring at the sky and filling with rain like tears. Her face was slightly familiar. He had seen her before.
Where?
The lightning died, and he was left with the image of her face in his mind, harsh and white, and reversed like a photograph's negative. The diner. The Coke floats. Friday. School quitting time. A Crown Victoria, 3 passengers. He had pegged them as a sales team.
Wrong again.
Okay, he said out loud. Ball game over. He put Alice's gun back in his pocket and walked away north, back to the Jeep. It was so dark, and he had so much rain in his eyes, he thumped right into the side of it before he knew he was there. He tracked around it with a hand on the hood and found the driver's door, opened it and closed it, and opened it again just for the thrill of making the dome light come on inside. Illumination he could control for himself. It wasn't easy, driving back up onto the limestone. The grit that should have been under the wheels and aiding traction was now slick mud. He put the headlights on bright and started the wipers beating fast and selected four-wheel drive and slid around for a while before the front tires caught and dragged the car up the slope. Then he hooked a wide curve ahead and left, all the way across to the 7 o'clock position. He hit the horn twice, and Alice walked out of the mesquite into the headlight beams. She was soaked to the skin. Water was pouring off her. Her hair was plastered flat. Her ears stuck out a little. She stepped to her left and ran around to the passenger door. "I guess this is the storm people were expecting," he said. Lightning flared again outside. A ragged bolt far to their left, accompanied by an explosion of thunder. The weather was moving north, and fast. She shook her head.
"This little shower? This is just a taste. Wait until tomorrow."
"I'll be gone tomorrow."
"You will?"
He nodded. "You okay?" he asked.
"I didn't know when to fire."
"You did fine."
"What happened?"
He drove off again, turning south, zigzagging the Jeep to fan the headlight beams back and forth across the mesa. 30 feet in front of the wrecked VW, he found the first guy's body. It was humped and inert. He dipped the lights so they would shine directly on it and jumped out into the rain. The guy was dead. He had taken the Winchester's bullet in the stomach. He hadn't died instantaneously. His hat was missing, and he had torn open his jacket to clutch his wound. He had crawled quite a distance. He was tall and heavily built. Reacher closed his eyes and scanned back to the scene in the diner. By the register, the woman, 2 men, one big and fair, one small and dark. Then he walked back to the Jeep and slid inside. The seat was soaked. 2 dead, he said. "That's what happened. But the driver escaped. Did you ID him?"
"They came to kill us, didn't they?"
"That was the plan. Did you ID the driver?
She said nothing.
It's very important, Alice, he said. For Ellie's sake. We don't have a tongue. That part didn't work out. They're both dead.
She said nothing.
Did you see him?
She shook her head. No, not really, she said. I'm very sorry. I was running. The lights were only on a second or two.
It had seemed longer than that to reach her, much longer. But in reality, she was probably right. She was maybe even overestimating. It might have been only 3/4 of a second. They had been very quick with the triggers. I've seen these people before, he said. On Friday, up at the crossroads. Must have been after they got Eugene. They must have been scouting the area. 3 of them. A woman, a big guy, a small dark guy. I can account for the woman and the big guy. So was it the small dark guy driving tonight?
I didn't really see.
Gut feeling, Reacher said. First impression. You must have gotten a glimpse or seen a silhouette.
Didn't you?
He nodded. He was facing away from me, looking down to where you fired from. There was a lot of glare, some rain on his windshield. Then I was shooting, and then he took off. But I don't think he was small. She nodded, too.
Gut feeling. He wasn't small. Or dark. It was just a blur, but I'd say he was big enough. Maybe fair-haired?
Makes sense, Reacher said. They left one of the team behind to guard Ellie.
So who was driving?
Their client. The guy who hired them. That's my guess. Because they were short-handed and because they needed local knowledge.
He got away.
Reacher smiled. He can run, but he can't hide. They went to take a look at the wrecked VW. It was beyond help. Alice didn't seem too concerned about it. She just shrugged and turned away. Reacher took the maps from the glove compartment and turned the Jeep around and headed north. The drive back to the Red House was a nightmare. Crossing the mesa was okay, but beyond the end of it, the desert track was baked so hard that it wasn't absorbing any water at all. The rain was flooding all over the surface. The part that had felt like a riverbed was a riverbed. It was pouring with a fast torrent that boiled up over the tires. Mesquite bushes had been torn off their deep taproots and washed out of their shallow toeholds, and whole trees were racing south on the swirl. They dammed against the front of the Jeep and rode with it until cross currents tore them loose. Sinkholes were concealed by the tide. But the rain was easing fast. It was dying back to drizzle. The eye of the storm had blown away to the north. They were right next to the motor barn before they saw it. It was in total darkness. Reacher braked hard and swerved around it and saw pale lights flickering behind some of the windows in the house. Candles, he said.
Power must be out, Alice said. The lightning must have hit the lines.
He braked again and slid in the mud and turned the car so the headlights washed deep into the barn. Recognize anything? He asked. Bobby's pickup was back in its place, but it was wet and streaked with mud. Water was dripping out of the load bed and pooling on the ground.
Okay,
Alice said. So, what now? Reacher stared into the mirror, then he turned his head and watched the road from the north. Somebody's coming, he said. There was a faint glow of headlights behind them, rising and falling, many miles distant, breaking into 1,000 pieces in the raindrops on the Jeep's windows. Let's go say howdy to the Greers, he said. He pulled Alice's gun out of his pocket and checked it. Never assume. But it was okay. Cocked and locked. 7 left. He put it back in his pocket, then drove across the soaking yard to the foot of the porch steps. The rain was almost gone. The ground was beginning to steam. The vapor rose gently and swirled in the headlight beams. They got out into the humidity. The temperature was coming back. So was the insect noise. There was a faint, whirring chant all around. It sounded wary and very distant. He led her up the porch steps and pushed open the door. The hallway had candles burning in holders placed here and there on all the available horizontal surfaces. They gave a soft orange glow and made the foyer warm and inviting. He ushered Alice through to the parlor, stepped in behind her. More candles were burning in there, dozens of them. They were glued to saucers with melted wax. There was a Coleman lantern standing on a credenza against the end wall. It was hissing softly and burning bright. Bobby and his mother were sitting together at the red-painted table. Shadows were dancing and flickering all around them. The candlelight was kind to Rusty. It took 20 years off her. She was fully dressed in jeans and a shirt. Bobby sat beside her, looking at nothing in particular. The tiny flames lit his face and made it mobile. "Isn't this romantic?" Reacher said. Rusty moved awkwardly.
"I'm scared of the dark," she said. "Can't help it. Always have been."
"You should be," Reacher said. "Bad things can happen in the dark." She made no reply to that. "Tell?" Reacher asked. He was dripping water all over the floor. So was Alice.
"In the kitchen?" Rusty said.
There was a thin striped towel on a wooden roller. Alice blotted her face and hair and patted her shirt. Reacher did the same, and then he stepped back into the parlor.
"Why are you both up?" he asked. "It's 3 o'clock in the morning."
Neither of them answered.
"Your truck was out tonight," Reacher said.
"But we weren't," Bobby said. "We stayed inside, like you told us to."
Rusty nodded.
"Both of us, together."
Reacher smiled.
"Each other's alibi," he said. "That would get them rolling in the aisles down in the jury room."
"We didn't do anything," Bobby said.
Reacher heard a car on the road, just the faint, subliminal sound of tires slowing on soaked blacktop. The faint whistle of drive belts turning under a hood. Then there was a slow, wet crunch as it turned under the gate. Grit and pebbles popped under the wheels as it drove up to the porch. There was a tiny squeal from a brake rotor, and then silence as the engine died. The clunk of a door closing. Feet on the porch steps. The house door opening, footsteps crossing the foyer. Then the parlor door opened. The candle flames swayed and flickered. Hack Walker stepped into the room.
"Good," Reacher said. "We don't have much time."
"Did you rob my office?"
Walker replied. Reacher nodded.
"I was curious."
"About what?"
"About details," Reacher said. "I'm a details guy."
"You didn't need to break in. I'd have shown you the files."
"You weren't there."
"Whatever, you shouldn't have broken in. You're in trouble for it. You can understand that, right? Big trouble."
Reacher smiled. "Bad luck and trouble, been my only friends."
"Sit down, Hack," he said.
Walker paused a second, then he threaded his way around all the chairs and sat down next to Rusty Greer. Candlelight lit his face. The lantern glowed to his left.
"You got something for me?" he asked.
Reacher sat opposite, laid his hands palm down on the wood.
"I was a cop of sorts for 13 years, he said.
"So?"
"I learned a lot of stuff."
"Like?"
"Like, lies are messy. They get out of control."
But the truth is messy, too. So any situation you're in, you expect rough edges. Anytime I see anything that's all buttoned up, I get real suspicious. And Carmen's situation was messy enough to be real. But I came to see there were a couple of edges that were just too rough.
Like what?
Like she had no money with her. I know that. 2 million in the bank, and she travels 300 miles with a single dollar in her purse, sleeps in the car, doesn't eat, leapfrogs from one mobile station to the next just to keep going. That didn't tie up for me.
She was play-acting. That's who she is.
You know who Nicholas Copernicus is?
Was, Walker said.
Some old astronomer. Polish, I think. Prove the Earth goes around the sun?
Reacher nodded.
And much more than that, by implication.
He asked us all to consider how likely is it that we're at the absolute center of things? What are the odds that what we're seeing is somehow exceptional, the very best or the very worst? It's an important philosophical point.
So, if Carmen had 2 million bucks in the bank, but traveled with a single dollar, just in case she bumped into a guy as suspicious as me, then she is undoubtedly the number one best-prepared con artist in the history of the world. And old Copernicus asks me, how likely is that I should by chance happen to bump into the best con artist in the history of the world? His answer is, not very likely, really. He says the likelihood is, if I bump into a con artist at all, it'll be a very average and mediocre one.
So what are you saying?
I'm saying it didn't tie up for me. So it got me thinking about the money. And then something else didn't tie up.
What?
Al Eugene's people messengered Sloop's financial stuff over, right?
This morning. Feels like a long time ago.
Thing is, I saw Al's office when I went to the museum. It's literally within sight of the courthouse. It's a 1 minute walk, so how likely is it they would messenger something over? Wouldn't they just walk it over? For a friend of Al's, especially if it was urgent, it would take them 10 times as long just to dial the phone for the courier's service. The candlelight danced and flickered. The red room glowed.
People messenger things all the time, Walker said. It's routine.
And it was too hot. Or walking. Reacher nodded.
Maybe.
It didn't mean much at the time. But then something else didn't tie up. The collarbone.
What about it?
Reacher turned to face Alice. When you fell off your inline skates, did you break your collarbone?
No,
Alice said.
Any injuries at all?
I tore up my hand. A lot of road rash.
You put your hand out to break your fall?
Reflex, she said. It's impossible not to.
Reacher nodded, turned back through the candlelit gloom to Walker. I rode with Carmen on Saturday, he said. My first time ever. My ass got sore. But the thing I really remember is how high I was. It's scary up there. So the thing is, if Carmen fell off from that height onto rocky dirt hard enough to bust her collarbone, how was it that she didn't get road rash, too, on her hand?
Maybe she did. Hospital didn't write it up. Maybe they forgot.
It was a very detailed report. New staff working hard. I noticed that. And Colin Black did, too. He said they were very thorough. They wouldn't have neglected lacerations to the palm. She must have worn riding gloves.
Reacher shook his head. She told me nobody wears gloves down here. Too hot. And she definitely wouldn't have said that if gloves had once saved her from serious road rash. She'd have been a big fan of gloves in that case. She'd have certainly made me wear them, being new to it.
So,
I started to wonder if the collarbone thing could have been from Sloop hitting her. I figured it was possible. Maybe she's on her knees, a big clubbing fist from above, she moves her head. Only she also claimed he had broken her arm and her jaw, and knocked her teeth loose, too. And there was no mention of all that stuff. So I stopped wondering, especially when I found out the ring was real. A candle on the left end of the table died. It burned out, and smoke rose from it in a thin plume that ran absolutely straight for a second, and then spiraled crazily.
"She's a liar," Walker said. "That's all."
"She sure is," Bobby said.
"Sloop never hit her," Rusty said. "A son of mine would never hit a woman, whoever she was."
"One at a time, okay?" Reacher said quietly. He could feel the impatience in the room, elbows shifting on the table, feet moving on the floor. He turned to Bobby first. "You claim she's a liar," he said, "and I know why. It's because you don't like her, because you're a racist piece of shit, and because she had an affair with a school teacher. So, among other things, you took it on yourself to try and turn me off of her, some kind of loyalty to your brother." Then he turned to Rusty. "We'll get to what Sloop did and didn't do real soon, but right now, you keep quiet, okay? Hack and I have business."
"What business?" Walker said.
"This business," Reacher said, and propped Alice's gun on the tabletop, the butt resting on the wood and the muzzle pointing straight at Walker's chest.
"What the hell are you doing?" Walker said.
Reacher clicked the safety off with his thumb. The snick sounded loud in the room. Candles flickered, and the lantern hissed softly. "I figured out the thing with the diamond," he said. "Then everything else made sense, especially with you giving us the badges and sending us down here to speak with Rusty."
"What are you talking about?"
"It was like a conjuring trick, the whole thing. You knew Carmen pretty well, so you knew what she must have told me, which was the absolute truth, always. The truth about herself and about what Sloop was doing to her. So you just exactly reversed everything. It was simple, a very neat and convincing trick. Like, she told me she was from Napa, and you said, 'Hey, I bet she told you she's from Napa, but she isn't, you know.' Like she told me she had called the IRS, and you said, 'Hey, I bet she told you she called the IRS, but she didn't, really.' It was like you knew the real truth and were reluctantly exposing commonplace lies she had told before. But it was you who was lying. All along, it was very, very effective, like a conjuring trick. And you dressed it all up behind pretending you wanted to save her. You fooled me for a long time."
"I did want to save her. I am saving her."
"Bullshit, Hack. Your only aim all along was to coerce a confession out of her for something she didn't do. It was a straightforward plan. Your hired guns kidnapped Ellie today so you could force Carmen to confess. I was your only problem. I stuck around. I recruited Alice. We were in your face from Monday morning onward. So you misled us for 27 straight hours.
You let us down slowly and regretfully, point by point. It was beautifully done. Well, almost. To really make it work, you'd have to be the best con artist in the world. And like old Copernicus says, what are the odds that the best con artist in the world would happen to be up there in Pecos? There was silence. Just sputtering wax, the hissing of the lantern, five people breathing. The old air conditioner wasn't running. No power.
You're crazy, Walker said.
No, I'm not. You decoyed me by being all regretful about what a liar Carmen was and how desperate you were to save her. You were even smart enough to reveal a cynical reason for wanting to save her. About wanting to be a judge, so I wouldn't think you were too good to be true. That was a great touch, Hack. But all the time you were talking to her on the phone, muffling your voice to get past the desk clerk, telling him you were her lawyer, telling her if she ever spoke to a real lawyer, you'd hurt Ellie, which is why she refused to speak with Alice. Then you wrote out a bunch of phony financial statements on your own computer right there at your desk. One printout looks much the same as any other. And you drafted the phony trust deeds and the phony family services papers. You knew what real ones looked like, I guess. Then as soon as you heard your people had picked up the kid, you got back on the phone and coached Carmen through the phony confession, feeding back to her all the lies you had told to me. Then you sent your assistant downstairs to listen to them.
This is nonsense, Reacher shrugged.
So let's prove it. Let's call the FBI and ask them how the hunt for Ellie is going.
Phones are out, Bobby said. Electrical storm. Reacher nodded.
Okay, no problem. He kept the gun pointed at Walker's chest and turned to face Rusty.
Tell me what the FBI agents asked you, he said.
Rusty looked blank.
What FBI agents?
No FBI agents came here tonight. She just shook her head. Reacher nodded.
You were play-acting, Hack, he said. You told us you'd called the FBI and the state police, and there were roadblocks in place, and helicopters up, and more than 150 people on the ground, but you didn't call anybody. Because if you had, the very first thing they would have done is come down here. They'd have talked to Rusty for hours. They'd have brought sketch artists and crime scene technicians. This is the scene of the crime, after all. And Rusty is the only witness.
You're wrong, Reacher, Walker said.
There were FBI people here, Bobby said. I saw them in the yard.
Reacher shook his head. They were people wearing FBI hats, he said. Two of them. But they aren't wearing those hats anymore. Walker said nothing.
Big mistake, Hack, Reacher said. Giving us those stupid badges and sending us down here? You're in law enforcement. You knew Rusty was the vital witness. You also knew she wouldn't cooperate fully with me. So it was an inexplicable decision for a DA to take, to send us down here. I couldn't believe it. Then I saw why. You wanted us out of the way, and you wanted to know where we were at all times, so you could send your people after us.
What people?
The hired guns, Hack. The people in the FBI hats. The people you sent to kill Al Eugene. The people you sent to kill Sloop. They were pretty good. Very professional. But the thing with professionals is they need to be able to work again in the future. Al Eugene was no problem. Could have been anybody. Out there in the middle of nowhere. But Sloop was harder. He was just home from prison. Wasn't going any place for a spell.
so it had to be done right here, which was risky. They made you agree to cover their asses by framing Carmen. Then you made them agree to help you do it by moonlighting as the kidnap team.
This is ridiculous, Walker said.
You knew Carmen had bought a gun, Reacher said. You told me. The paperwork comes through your office, and you knew why she bought it. You knew all about Sloop and what he did to her. You knew their bedroom was a torture chamber. So she wants to hide a gun in there? Where does she put it? Three choices, really. Top shelf of her closet, in her bedside table, or in her underwear drawer. Common sense. Same for any woman in any bedroom. I know it, and your people knew it. They probably watched through the window until she went to shower. They slipped some gloves on. A minute later, they're in the room. They cover Sloop with their own guns until they find Carmen's, and they shoot him with it. They're outside again, 30 seconds later. A quick sprint back to where they left their car on the road, and they're gone. This house is a warren. But you know it well. You're a friend of the family. You assured them they could be in and out without being seen. You probably drew them a floor plan. Walker closed his eyes, said nothing. He looked old and pale. The candlelight wasn't helping him. But you made mistakes, Hack, Reacher said. People like you always make mistakes. The financial reports were clumsy. Lots of money, but hardly any expenditure? How likely is that? What is she, a miser, too? And the messenger thing was a bad slip. If they had been messengered, you'd have left them in the courier packet, like you did with the medical reports, to make them look even more official. Walker opened his eyes, defiant.
The medical reports, he repeated. You saw them. They proved she was lying. You heard Cowan Black say it.
Reacher nodded. Leaving them in the FedEx packet was neat. They looked real urgent, like they were hot off the truck. But you should have torn the label off the front. Because the thing is, FedEx charges by weight. And I weighed the packet on Alice's kitchen scales, 1 pound, 1 ounce. But the label said 2 pounds and 9 ounces. So one of two things must have happened. Either FedEx ripped off the hospital by padding the charge, or you took out about 60% of the contents and trashed them. And you know what? I vote for you checking the contents before you sent them over to us. You've been a DA for a spell. You've tried a lot of cases. You know what convincing evidence looks like. So anything about the beatings went straight in the trash. All you left were the genuine accidents. But the road rash thing passed you by, so you left the collarbone in by mistake. Or maybe you felt you had to leave it in because you know she's got a healed knot clearly visible, and you figured I'd have noticed it. Walker said nothing. The lantern hissed.
The broken arm, the jaw, the teeth, Reacher said.
My guess is there are 5 or 6 more folders in a dumpster somewhere. Probably not behind the courthouse. Probably not in your backyard either. I guess you're smarter than that. Maybe they're in a trash can at the bus station. Some big public place. Walker said nothing. The candle flames danced. Reacher smiled.
But you were mostly pretty good, he said.
When I figured Carmen wasn't the shooter, you steered it straight back to a conspiracy involving Carmen. You didn't miss a beat. Even when I made the link to Eugene, you kept on track. You were very shocked. You went all gray and sweaty. Not because you were upset about Al, but because he'd been found so soon. You hadn't planned on that. But still, you thought for 10 seconds and came up with the IRS motive. But you know what? You were so busy thinking, you forgot to be scared enough about the two or three possibility. It was a plausible threat. You should have been much more worried. Anybody else would have been. Walker said nothing. And you got Sloop out on a Sunday, Reacher said. Not easy to do. But you didn't do it for him. You did it so he could be killed on a Sunday. So Carmen could be framed on a Sunday and spend the maximum time in jail before visitors could get near her the next Saturday. To give yourself 5 clear days to work on her. Walker said nothing.
Lots of mistakes, Hack, Reacher said,
including sending people after me. Like old Copernicus says, what were the chances they'd be good enough? Walker said nothing. Bobby was leaning forward, staring sideways across his mother, looking straight at him, catching on, slowly.
You sent people to kill my brother? He breathed.
No, Walker said. Reacher's wrong.
Bobby stared at him like he had answered yes instead.
But why would you? He asked. You were friends.
Then Walker looked up, straight at Reacher.
Yes, why would I? He said. What possible motive could I have?
Something Benjamin Franklin once wrote, Reacher said.
What the hell does that mean?
You wanted to be a judge. Not because you wanted to do good. That was all sanctimonious bullshit. It was because you wanted the trappings. You were born a poor boy, and you were greedy for money and power. And it was right there in front of you. But first, you had to get elected. And what sort of a thing stops a person getting elected? Walker just shrugged.
Old scandals, Reacher said, among other things.
Old secrets coming back at you from the past. Sloop and Al and you were a threesome way back when. Did all kinds of stuff together. You three against the world. You told me that. So there's Sloop, in prison for cheating on his taxes. He can't stand it in there. So he thinks, how do I get out of here? Not by repaying my debts. By figuring, my old pal Hack is running for judge this year. Big prize. All that money and power. What's he prepared to do to get it? So he calls you up and says he could start some serious rumors about some old activities if you don't broker his way out of there. You think it over carefully. You figure Sloop wouldn't incriminate himself by talking about something you all did together, so at first you relax. Then you realize there's a large gap between the sort of fact that would convict you, and the sort of rumors that would wreck your chances in the election. So you cave in. You take some of your campaign donations and arrange to pay off the IRS with it. Now, Sloop's happy. But you're not. In your mind, the cat is out of the bag. Sloop's threatened you once. What about the next time he wants something? And Al's involved, because he's Sloop's lawyer, so now it's all fresh in Al's mind, too. Your chances of making judge are suddenly vulnerable. Walker said nothing. You know what Ben Franklin once wrote? Reacher asked.
What?
3 can keep a secret, if 2 of them are dead. Silence in the room. No movement, no breathing, just the soft hiss of the lantern and the flickering of the tiny candle flames.
What was the secret? Alice whispered.
3 boys in rural Texas, Reacher said. Growing up together, playing ball, having fun. They get a little older, they turn their attention to what their dads are doing.
the guns, the rifles, the hunting. Maybe they start with the armadillos. They shouldn't, really, because they're protected by the tree huggers. But the attitude is, they're on my land, they're mine to hunt. Bobby said that to me. An arrogant attitude. A superior attitude. I mean, hey, what's an armadillo worth? But armadillos are slow and boring prey. Too easy. The three boys are growing up. They're three young men now. High school seniors. They want a little more excitement. So they go looking for coyotes, maybe. Worthier opponents. They hunt at night. They use a truck. They range far and wide. And soon they find bigger game. Soon they find a real thrill.
What?
Mexicans, Reacher said. Poor, anonymous, no-account brown families stumbling north through the desert at night. And I mean, hey, what are they worth? Are they even human? But they make great prey. They run, and they squeal, almost like hunting actual people, right? Hack. Silence in the room. Maybe they started with a girl, Reacher said. Maybe they didn't mean to kill her, but they did anyway. Maybe they had to. Couple of days, they're nervous. They hold their breath, but there's no comeback. Nobody reacts. Nobody even cares. So, hey, this is suddenly fun. Then they're out often. It becomes a sport, the ultimate kill, better than armadillos. They take that old pickup, one of them driving, two of them riding in the load bed. They hunt for hours. Bobby said Sloop invented that technique, said he was real good at it. I expect he was. I expect they all were. They got plenty of practice. They did it 25 times in a year. That was the Border Patrol, Bobby said. No, it wasn't. The report wasn't a whitewash. It didn't read like one, and the inside word is it was kosher. Sergeant Rodriguez told me that. And people like Sergeant Rodriguez know things like that, believe me. The investigation got nowhere because it was looking in the wrong place. It wasn't a bunch of rogue officers. It was three local boys called Sloop Greer and Al Eugene and Hack Walker. Having fun in that old pickup truck that's still parked in your barn. Boys would be boys, right? Silence in the room. The attacks were mostly in Echo County, Reacher said. That struck me as odd. Why would the Border Patrol come so far north? Truth is, they didn't. Three Echo boys went a little ways south instead. Silence. The attacks stopped in late August, Reacher said. Why was that? Not because the investigation scared them off. They didn't know about the investigation. It was because college opens early September. They went off to be freshmen. The next summer, it was too dangerous, or they'd grown out of it, and they didn't ever do it again. The whole thing faded into history until 12 years later, Sloop was sitting in a cell somewhere and dragged it all up because he was so desperate to get out. Everybody was staring straight at Walker. His eyes were closed tight, and he was deathly pale. It seems so unfair, right? Reacher said to him. All that was way in the past. Maybe you weren't even a willing participant in the first place. Maybe the others dragged you into it. And now it was all coming back at you.
It was a nightmare. It was going to ruin your life. It was going to take away the big prize. So you made some calls, made some decisions. Three can keep a secret if two of them are dead. Another candle died. The wick hissed and smoke plumed.
No, Walker said. It wasn't like that.
The lantern flickered behind him. Shadows danced on the ceiling.
So what was it like? Reacher asked.
I was just going to take Ellie. Just temporarily. I hired some local people to do it. I had plenty of campaign money. They watched her for a week. I went up to the jail and told Sloop, don't mess with me. But he didn't care. He said, go ahead and take Ellie. He didn't want her. He was all conflicted. He married Carmen to punish himself for what we did, I think. That's why he hit her all the time. She was a permanent reminder. He thought she could read it in him, see it in his eyes like voodoo. Ellie, too. He thought she could see it in him. So taking her wasn't a threat to Sloop.
So then you hired some more people. Walker nodded.
They took over and got rid of the watchers for me. And then they got rid of Al and Sloop. It was a long time ago, Reacher. He shouldn't have brought it up. We were kids at the time. We all agreed we would never even mention it again. We promised each other. Never. Ever. It was the unmentionable thing, like it had never happened, like it was just a bad dream. A year long. There was silence.
You were driving the truck tonight, Reacher said. Walker nodded again, slowly.
You too? Then it would have been over. I knew you knew, you see. I mean, why else would you steal the files and lead us out into the desert? So I drove the truck. Why not? I'd driven out there at night before, many times.
Then he went quiet, swallowed hard twice, closed his eyes.
But I got scared, he said. I got sick. I couldn't go through with it. Not again. I'm not that person anymore. I changed.
Silence in the room.
Where's Ellie? Reacher asked.
Walker shrugged and shook his head. Reacher fished in his pocket and came out with the chromium star.
Is this thing legal? He asked.
Walker opened his eyes, nodded.
Technically, I guess, he said.
So I'm going to arrest you. Walker shook his head, vaguely.
No, he said. Please. Are you armed? Reacher asked him.
Walker nodded.
Pistol in my pocket.
Get it for me, Mrs. Greer, Reacher said. Rusty turned in her chair and went for Walker's pocket. He offered no resistance, even leaned sideways to make it easier for her. She came out with a small, blued steel revolver, a Colt Detective Special, 38 caliber, 6 shots, 2-inch barrel, a small weapon. Rusty cradled it in her palm and it looked right at home in a woman's hand.
Where's Ellie, Hack? Reacher asked again.
I don't know, Walker said.
I really don't. They use motels. I don't know which one. They wouldn't tell me. They said it's safer that way.
How do you contact them?
A Dallas number. It must be rerouted.
Phones are out, Bobby said.
Where is she? Hack,
Reacher asked again.
I don't know. I'd tell you if I did.
Reacher raised Alice's gun, held it straight out across the table. His arms were long,
and the muzzle came to rest 2 feet from Walker's face.
"Watch the trigger finger, Hack," he said.